President John F. Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 is generally regarded as one of the triumphs of his administration. But in his latest book, Frederick Kempe argues that it could have been avoided if the president had brought more sophistication to his dealings with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev over the previous year, particularly in regard to the construction of the Berlin Wall. Mr. Kempe, former reporter and editor at The Wall Street Journal, is now the president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based think tank. His book, Berlin 1961, is published by G.P. Putnam Sons, and I'm pleased that it has brought him back to our show today.
It's an honor to be back here, Leonard.
Your book reads as something of an indictment of President Kennedy, at least as far as his foreign policy is concerned. Was that what you had in mind when you set out to write it?
No. I wanted to tell the story of what I thought was the most decisive place in the Cold War, the epicenter of the Cold War, Berlin, and what I thought was the most decisive year. It was once I got into the documents that it became clear to me that this really was, and I call it one of the worst inaugural foreign policy performances, inaugural year foreign policy performances of any modern presidency. And when you look at it, it does add up like that. You had the Bay of Pigs, CIA-backed a group of Cuban exiles.
Of course, that was something that some people would say was really just a carryover from the Eisenhower administration.
Right, but he could have also said, I'm not going to do this at all. He had two choices. He could say, I'm not going to do this at all because it makes no sense. Or he could say, I'm going to give it the wherewithal to succeed. And he did neither. What we know is Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader at that time, told his son that he couldn't believe that Kennedy was so indecisive. So he's already painting a picture of Kennedy at that time. And he compares it with his own action in Hungary in 1956, where there was an uprising, and he puts it down in quite a bloody way.
You also mentioned Kennedy's performance at the summit in Vienna in June 1961, where he was, you say, humiliated by the more sophisticated Khrushchev, his tacit acceptance of the construction of the Berlin Wall, and finally the face-off between Soviet and U.S. tanks at Checkpoint Charlie in October 1961, all in the first year of the administration.
Well, events drive stories, and there certainly were a host of events.
But they were all connected in some
ways. They were all connected. Bay of Pigs shows weakness to Khrushchev. Vienna summit is interesting because Khrushchev, if you're thinking about a soccer player controlling the field and controlling the ball, Khrushchev does that over the 2 days of the summit. And Kennedy is so distraught at the end of the summit that he actually calls into a room the very famous New York Times columnist James Scotty Reston and uses him as a confessor. And he says, worst day of my life, he savaged me. And Kennedy knows at that point he's got a problem because Khrushchev thinks he's weak.
It's interesting that the way we remember the two men is Kennedy as this sophisticated man and Khrushchev as this vulgarian who took off his shoe and banged it at the UN. But you suggest that Khrushchev was maybe he came from less fancy stock, but that he was the more sophisticated man always?
I don't call him more sophisticated in the book. In fact, he's quite erratic and he's bombastic and he's brutal. But what he is more clever. He's definitely more clever, and he really outmaneuvers Kennedy at this period of time. Though I also make a very early argument that Khrushchev is reaching out to Kennedy. On the first day that Kennedy is in office, he releases captured American pilots. He prints the entire inaugural speech of John F. Kennedy. That was unprecedented in the Soviet Union. So he's actually trying to go in a direction of peaceful coexistence with Kennedy. And Kennedy instead looks at a very routine propaganda speech of Khrushchev, which is much more hawkish, but really was just routine. And he thinks this shows him who the real Khrushchev is. And the reason I point out that story is it's a young president. It's an inexperienced president. And he makes a very amateurish mistake at that point, misreading Khrushchev.
But aren't they misreading each other?
All the way through. All the way through.
You've come to believe that the military standoff between the Soviet and U.S. tanks in October 61 had a greater potential to create a thermonuclear disaster than any of the events that followed. We tend to think of the Cuban Missile Crisis as being that kind of situation. But Checkpoint Charlie?
Yeah. Two things. First of all, the Cuban Missile Crisis was when Kennedy finally stands up to the Soviet Union. It is where he stands down Khrushchev. But I argue that the Cuban Missile Crisis never would have happened if Khrushchev had not concluded from Berlin in 1961 that Kennedy could be had, that he could put these missiles in place. The tank showdown in October of 1961, the reason this was so dangerous, neither side wanted war, but through a series of escalations, you suddenly had for the first and last time Soviet and U.S. tanks and fighting men 100 yards apart pointed at each other across Checkpoint Charlie. And they were there disputing a very arcane four-power right of whether or not Allied personnel should be showing their identity cards while going through. While going through the crossing, General Clay, who has been brought back by Kennedy to Berlin, hero of the Berlin Airlift in 1948, he's been brought back largely for PR reasons. But General Clay doesn't know that, and he wants to reassert American rights there. And the reason I call that so dangerous is you could have had a nervous trigger finger, you could have had an overzealous commander, a shot could have gone off, and then war starts from those sorts of moments.
Yeah, I've been to Checkpoint Charlie, not during the old days, but more recently, and it's kind of hard to believe that this could have been where a war started. It's just in the middle of town.
It's in the middle of town, and those days in the middle of the world. And that's what we forget, is it's the only place in the world where the Soviets and the U.S. were there, both with their troops and tanks, without intermediation before the wall went up.
You contend that East Berlin and much of Eastern Europe could have had a much different history if Kennedy had reacted differently to Khrushchev's decision to build a wall to divide the German capital. What could he have done?
Well, General Scowcroft rightly writes in his introduction to my book, and I think he was trying to say this to me at the same time, that history doesn't reveal its alternatives. So we don't really know what would have happened if Kennedy had acted differently. What we do know as at the Vienna summit, Kennedy sent a different message than presidents before had sent to the Soviets. He essentially sent the message that if you don't touch West Berlin access, West Berlin freedom, you can do whatever you want to do to stop the flow of refugees out of East Germany. And that was really the problem. Thousands of refugees bleeding out of this Soviet satellite state, its westernmost outpost. And the reason I think it could have changed the world, if the wall doesn't go up, those refugees keep flowing out. And let's not forget, in 1989, it was a flood of refugees that in the end that brought down the Soviet Empire, brought down the Berlin Wall. The question is, if Kennedy had sent the right message in Vienna, a tougher message, a clearer message, don't cross this line, would Khrushchev not have overseen the construction of the Berlin Wall? I think he was not a risk taker. Khrushchev wasn't. I think he did it once he knew he could do it without danger of the U.S. troops striking back.
And Kennedy thought that this might appease Khrushchev and make him more willing to negotiate a nuclear agreement with the United States?
And in a way, you can understand that he would have thought that.
Soon after he came to office did all of this happen?
It was his first year.
Months?
He comes into office the end of January. Bay of Pigs is in April. Vienna summit is in June. The wall goes up in August. The tank showdown in Checkpoint Charlie's October. This is rat-a-tat in his first year in office. And our presidents come into office unprepared for what they're going to face. They're playing match point on the day of their inauguration.
Well, this would have been a problem for Eisenhower as well, although he did know Europe perhaps a little better. Kennedy said a wall is better than a war.
Well, he certainly thought that, but was that actually what the case was? He thought the wall, as you said, was going to create a more pliable negotiating partner. And he had bigger things in mind. He wanted a nuclear test ban. He wanted to see if he could come up with more global agreements with the Soviet Union. He calculated by letting Khrushchev solve his problem in Berlin, he would have a more cooperative partner. And it was a tragic misreading. Instead, he got the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Because Khrushchev came to regard Kennedy's acquiescence as evidence of weakness?
Yes, and he made that quite clear in conversations with his son and others.
Well, it's interesting that after the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, many newscasts played Kennedy's famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech as a way of showing the long history of American opposition to the wall. You seem to suggest he was being given a pass.
There are two Kennedys. I do think Kennedy was given a pass on his performance in 1961, which was really terrible. And Kennedy admits this himself in a conversation with Ellie Abel, the Detroit News Bureau chief, and by the way, my former dean at Columbia Journalism School. Ellie Abel says to President Kennedy, "I really would like to write a book about your first year in office." And Kennedy says to Ellie Abel, "Why would anyone want to read a book about an administration that has nothing to show for itself but a string of disasters?" So Kennedy admits 61 is bad, but then his turning point is the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think there are two administrations, one post-Cuban Missile Crisis where Kennedy finally reacts, and then before that, Berlin 1961.
What role did the back channel of communication that was set up between Bobby Kennedy and Georgi Bolshakov, a Soviet spy, play in all of this?
Leonard, I'm so glad you asked about that. That's one of my favorite parts of the entire book, and I do write about this more than other historians, journalists have. There's a secret conduit between Bobby Kennedy and Georgi Bolshakov. Nothing of this sort has ever happened before. Someone this close to the American president, brother, attorney general, confidant, is meeting with an intelligence agent of the major adversary of the day, and it played a role in setting up the Vienna summit.
Fed misinformation?
The Kennedys thought they were getting the real thing, and they set this up after the Bay of Pigs because they had come to distrust their military and intelligence, and so they wanted a more direct line to Khrushchev. But ahead of the Vienna summit, Bolshakov was carrying messages, you know, we will not make a big deal out of Berlin. They thought they were going into the Vienna summit in a situation that was under control. And it wasn't at all. So I think Bolshakov did mislead them. The big moment was the tank showdown, where Bobby says in his own oral history that his meeting with Bolshakov on the night before the Soviets withdrew their tanks was decisive in solving that crisis. It will remain one of the great mysteries of the Cold War because Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. He says himself in his oral history that he regrets that he didn't make more notes of his meetings with Bolshakov, which took place during 1961 almost every 2 weeks.
Now, we're talking about Kennedy and his brother, but what about the other people in the administration? Should we be surprised that the president didn't get better foreign policy advice from his own staff that first year? Some of those people were quite experienced.
Some things don't change so much in Washington. And Kennedy had a divided administration. He brought in Dean Acheson, a hawk, the former Secretary of State to President Truman, who did a review of NATO and Berlin policy. But on the other hand, and he was aligned with the Berlin desk and people on the Berlin desk, Fay Coiler and others, who were more hardliners in Berlin. And then there was another group, and they were called slobs by the hardliners. And the slob is an acronym that stands for softliner on Berlin. And they were Schlesinger and Adlai Stevenson and Averell Harriman and the ambassador at that time, Tommy Thompson, in Moscow. Kennedy never really adjudicates between these two, and he goes back and forth between very, very hardline rhetoric. And if you look at his speeches sound very hardline, but his actions actually during 1961 aren't hardline. So he's talking loudly but carrying a small stick during that year.
Perhaps because Democrats are often very defensive about being called soft on defense and related matters.
You're absolutely right. But what's interesting about Kennedy is in his campaign against Richard Nixon in 1960.
Yeah, he did talk about the missile gap and all of that.
He took a more hawkish stance than did the Republican Vice President Richard Nixon. And it may be the reason that he got elected in the end because he took that. And his father was quite a hawk as well. And so even though he comes from a Democratic Party that has this more dovish wing, it was very divided at that time. And the 1960 election brought into power a lot of Southern Democrats. And so Kennedy's domestic politics and Khrushchev's domestic politics both pushed them more in a direction of confrontation.
My guest is Frederick Kempe, whose latest book is Berlin 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. It's published by Putnam. You've suggested that Khrushchev made his conciliatory gestures, the ones that Kennedy wasn't picking up on, at least in part because he understood that his own position at home wasn't as strong as he would have liked it to be.
If I could start my career all over and as a foreign policy analyst, I would focus on domestic politics and their impact on foreign policy, whether it's President Obama, President Kennedy. But what we forget is authoritarian countries also have domestic politics. Iran today has domestic politics, and it's crucial.
But we're seeing it in the Middle East and all of the countries where people are now protesting against their authoritarian governments, largely because they want jobs, they want lower food prices.
Absolutely. And the domestic politics of Libya is going to be decisive of whether Gaddafi continues to keep his military support, doesn't keep his military support. It was the same for Egypt in Egypt with Mubarak. But we don't understand domestic politics in authoritarian countries well enough. Khrushchev was weakened in May of 1960 when his troops shot down an American U-2 spy plane.
I always thought that was a triumph.
It should have been. It should have been a triumph.
Gary Powers admitted that he was spying on the Soviet Union.
But Khrushchev tells a doctor later, many years later, visiting his daughter, that that was the moment from which he wasn't in full control. What happened was Stalinist remnants never forgave Khrushchev for denouncing Stalin in 1956. They never thought it was the right course. He was pursuing a course of peaceful coexistence with the West. When that spy plane is shot down, they use it as proof that Khrushchev is being naive. These are the people you're trying to make peace with, and they're flying over our country, and they're endangering us. From that point on, Stalinist remnants are fighting against him. China's Mao Zedong is arguing in the world communist movement he's not strong enough, and his most vulnerable spot is East Germany. So for him, East Germany is a domestic political problem over which he could lose his job. And all the time during 1961, he's looking to October, which is the October Party Congress. He has brought down opponents at such party congresses, and he knows he has to go into that party congress in a good position.
He had foiled a coup attempt in 1957.
He foiled a coup attempt in 1957. He consolidated power, and then in 1960, with the U-2 incident, he becomes under some challenge again.
And did it matter whether Mao Zedong called his conciliatory gestures a communist betrayal? Did that play at all within the Kremlin?
It played within the Kremlin. If you're an opponent to Khrushchev, you're looking for a moment to get back at him. And after the 1957 coup, you don't have much of a chance. He's really consolidated his power. 1960, you actually use whatever you've got if you think this man should not be leading your country. And so Mao Zedong, the fact that he's losing credibility as the leader of the world communist movement plays a role. The fact that he's not acting tough enough in Berlin, helping Walter Ulbricht solve his problem, that plays a role. So I find in doing this book, one of the most fascinating bits of research was looking into the domestic politics of the Soviet Union.
Did Kennedy underestimate the political pressures that Khrushchev was facing within the Soviet Union? While overestimating Khrushchev's ability to consolidate power at home?
You know, we very often are – I think too often we don't understand the nuance of situations. Simplistically, he was a Soviet leader. He was the head of communism. He wanted to dominate the world. He just wanted to stay in power. And world domination was not really on Khrushchev's mind at that time. He wants to survive. And if we had had a more nuanced view of that world, but I think the Cold War fever the desire to simplify the situation between the Soviet Union and the U.S. made us miss opportunities with a Soviet leader who had reduced defense spending, had reduced the military, had denounced Stalin. So I think going up to Kennedy, we missed a lot of opportunities.
Well, yesterday we did a segment on the possibility that Putin and Medvedev are now competing, that they're now rivals, which they weren't in the past. But we don't know for sure. You could read it one way or you could read it another way. We're starting to have Kremlinologists reading the tea leaves again. Isn't that part of the problem, that it's just very difficult for people in the West to read what's going on in Moscow?
Well, I hope in this situation that our intelligence is better. It's certainly a more open world. We have many more abilities to listen in on conversations. And I hope we actually do know the nuance between Medvedev and Putin.
Well, we're not sure whether they're just doing this as a way of neither one dropping out of the race, or whether they're really angry with each other, or whether they have different visions.
Well, this is probably something for a whole different program, but I've been spending a lot of time talking to Russian businessmen who are very close to both. And their bet is that Putin's in charge. 70% he'll run for president next year, 20-25% Medvedev, and then – or no, I'm sorry, 5%, 10% Medvedev, 20% that Putin will pick another candidate to run against him. I think what's crucial to understand is the nuance. And these people have teams. They have people around them. And so even though Putin and Medvedev might be able to work out things between them, you have constituencies around each of them that are competing. So where I think you're absolutely right is – you can only know how to engage with these sorts of leaders if you know the nuances of their domestic politics.
And you've pointed out that Kennedy overreacted to a speech Khrushchev gave in Vienna in June 1961 that was filled with routine propaganda. Was that speech designed to reassure Soviet hardliners rather than announce to Kennedy and the world that he really intended to escalate the Cold War?
Kennedy is in office for all of 24 hours. He has not even met with his Soviet experts, and he's looking at two pieces of information. One of them are these gestures, Khrushchev releasing the RB-47 pilots, the airmen, the publishing of the inaugural speech, first time in history. True, I think quite genuine gestures where Khrushchev is saying, look, I'd really like to see if we can find some way to talk. He also looks at this speech given on January 9th. He's got a cable from his ambassador who's trying to show off a little bit, saying, you have to read this if you really want to understand Khrushchev. Kennedy starts handing this around to everybody close to him, saying, now I understand what I'm up against. He's escalating the Cold War against me, so he takes it quite personally. Christian Herter, the former foreign minister of the Eisenhower administration, which has just gone out of office, saw the same set of information and said, you know, it's interesting. It's a bit of an escalation of rhetoric, but there's really nothing new here. But this brilliant young president is also an amateur. He hasn't had any experience yet, and he's misreading. He's totally misreading the situation.
He's also going through aggressive medical treatment for problems with his back at the time. Did that have an effect?
We all now know about Kennedy's womanizing, and we know a lot about his medical treatments and his back pains and his Addison's disease. What I think I point a finger at is the fact that he was taking some pretty serious injections and had major pains right ahead of the Vienna summit, his most important meeting of the year. There was a doctor along with him, not just Janet Travell, who was the doctor of the White House, but there was a doctor named Max Jacobson, and he was known as Dr. Feelgood. And he was the doctor for Truman Capote, for Tennessee Williams. And he became part of the Kennedy entourage during the campaign. And Kennedy was taking these injections against depression, against fatigue. Bobby Kennedy later has these tested by the FDA. In these injections are enzymes, animal organs, vitamins, steroids, and amphetamines.
A lot of speed.
Amphetamines. So, and if you look at the side effects of that, anxiety, nervousness, impaired judgment, mood swings from depression to euphoria. It's not what you want the president of the United States to be shooting up just before he meets with the leader of his major adversary.
You have a photograph of him on crutches, something that they try to keep out of the news the same way they try to prevent people from seeing FDR in his wheelchair.
I looked long and hard for that photograph because I wanted to show it. Kennedy did not like to be photographed in crutches, and his rocking chair was all about that bad back.
Now, in the year afterward, you write about your mother, who was born in Berlin. How old was she when she moved with her family to Brooklyn?
She was a young teenager when she moved to Brooklyn, so she left already around 1930, 1931.
And you've said this book follows your mother's renegade spirit.
Well, my mother was a Berliner. And
a displaced Berliner or an American?
She was a Berliner the whole rest of her life, even though she came to America. You know, she went to Hunter College here in New York. They grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which was a very German part of New York in those days. But Berliners, they call it Berliner Schnauze, which means they talk quickly, they think quickly, they have really pronounced points of view. And I named my daughter after my mother, just to keep the Berliner in the family.
And she was honored just this past Friday with a posthumous degree by the University of Utah, where she had matriculated at the age of 66 after she'd retired from teaching.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. I was just in Utah accepting the degree on her behalf. She died at age 69 while she was working on her graduate degree, writing a dissertation about William Shakespeare's impact on the German philosopher Herder. So she was an extraordinary woman.
I'm assuming that you consulted with her when you needed to understand certain complicated translations from German.
Oh, absolutely. And our dinner table was a constant fight about whether or not the U.S. had abandoned and sold out Eastern Europe. And she would have been most fascinated by this book, because Kennedy is such a hero to so many people, and indeed he was a hero, indeed he was a great leader. But 1961, no one can dispute that he allowed the wall to come up that would stay for 30 years.
Frederick Kempe is president and CEO of the Atlantic Council, previously spent more than 25 years as a reporter, columnist, and editor at the Wall Street Journal. His book, Berlin, 1961, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth, is published by Putnam. Thank you so much for being with us again.